We recently interviewed a candidate for City Council for District 3 of Manhattan, Eric Botcher. Today we welcome competing candidate Leslie Boghossian Murphy to discuss her platform priorities and how we can build back resilient neighbourhoods. Leslie.
Yes.
Thank you very much for spending time today talking to Back the Neighbourhood. Yeah. Just about.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's very kind of you to spare the time. I know you're very busy with your campaign. Before we get into just talking about everything that's been going on in
sure.
recent years and particularly over the last year with COVID in District 3 that you're running for, and particularly the West Village, I'd love you to just give us a little bit of your backstory.
Sure. Yeah, I'll give you my background. I've lived in the district for 17 years. The same pre-war apartment. When I was a single girl, I came and I wanted to buy, and I saved all my money up, and back then, 17 years ago, it was actually doable. So I got a little one bedroom in Hell's Kitchen. That was 17 years ago, and then I got married, and now we're raising our 8-year-old daughter in the same apartment. We've expanded a little bit, but we're in the same Hell's Kitchen apartment that I started in. To go back a little further, just so you know a little bit about me and kind of like what makes me, I guess. All four of my grandparents fled Armenian genocide. They're genocide survivors. And they came here and they ended up here in New York. And then both my grandfathers had what you would call immigrant jobs. One was a window washer and the other was a factory worker. And then my dad, born and raised in Queens, went to college, you know, for free here, City College, when it was free.
Yeah.
We're trying to get back to that, but when it was free. And he kept telling me it was probably the best thing that ever happened to him as a poor kid, that he had that experience to have a free college education. And then when I was growing up, my parents owned a small little cheese store. So I think maybe that's why you and I were talking earlier. That's why maybe I connect so much to small businesses, because when I was younger, you know, you have core memories, right? You really remember certain things. And I remember my mom waking up when I was little, before the sun even came up, and going to the cheese store every day. And then my dad coming home way after dark. And then when I got a little older, I would do my homework behind the counter, you know, like a family business that you see a million of them here would do. And then I guess that hard work and that stick-to-itiveness stuck with me, and I became an investigative journalist. So I started in sports journalism, actually, and then I grew, and I really liked the news field. And I went around the world really asking hard questions, unrooting corruption, really giving people voices who didn't have them. And then I guess when I had Cecilia, like I said, 8 years ago, going around the world and leaving for weeks at a time was a little bit of a tougher sell. So I decided to just put my energies at home. And that's why I guess when people say, why are you running? You know, I never thought I would. I never said, you know, this is my path to be a politician. Mm-hmm. It happened very, very organically. First, I was on the board of my building. And then they're like, why don't you join the Black Association? And then I started volunteering at the Women and Children's Shelter. And now I'm on Community Board 4, which is a bigger lift. I'm on the Hudson River Park Trust Task Force. I'm on our district's Budget Task Force, which deals a lot with money and the priority of where we want to put our money for our district. Mm-hmm. And so I guess that all led me here to running today.
So where were you working when you were an investigative journalist?
So I started out at ESPN.
With sport.
Yeah, yeah. Sport. But then it turned investigative really quickly. So I did a lot of sports investigations. And people are like, oh, sports. I'm like, believe me, there's a lot of crime and stuff that goes on there. So
talk about Lance Armstrong and drugs.
Exactly.
Yeah. Icarus.
Exactly. One of my first, when I was at CNN, I was on the Ray Lewis murder trial. So I've been in courtrooms probably covering sports more than I've been on the field. Not really, but I mean, there's a lot going on. So then I was at sports networks for most of it. And then I had a chance to go to HDNet, which was a news station that Mark Cuban was starting. This is back in about 2005, something like that. And they said, listen, we got Dan Rather. He's doing his own show. We're also going to start a show called World Report. And we would love you to be a reporter and producer for that. Now, this is the deal. You won't have the visibility that you do in New York, being on the air all the time. But we'll pay you well, and you get to do really meaty investigative stories. So, Mark, I didn't really care about the visibility. I'm like, I don't care if no one sees me. I just want to go and do good stories. So I was really able, I went to Denmark, and I really studied wind energy, and that's where I kind of really got my background in that, and to Africa for food security. So that's kind of what, you know, built the building blocks of where I am.
Okay. So that interested in social justice and investigative mm-hmm. reporting, and then taking on more of a civic duty yeah. has led you to this point where you're now standing for District 3 mm-hmm. in a fairly intense race for the elections, which are happening, I believe, in June this year.
Yep.
Could you just talk about the campaign platform yeah. That you've adopted? I mean, I think it's fair to say that it's a Democratic district mm-hmm. and a lot of people would say that there's, you know, not a lot. You know, we talk about dancing on a pinhead and trying to pull apart the differences in the campaigns. Mm-hmm. But you have a line on your site, which is less talk, more action. Mm-hmm. Could you maybe just expand on that and specifically what your key campaign pillars are and what's important to you? I know you've just talked a bit about food insecurity and about environment, mm-hmm. but if you could maybe just unpack the core areas that you think are important for
Absolutely.
This district.
And you hit on it. So whoever wins this district, whoever wins the Democratic primary will win the seat. Yeah. You know, it's like you said, it's yeah. a Democratic. So that's where the race is. It's in the primary. I think pre-COVID is very different to now COVID times. I think COVID really exposed a lot of gaps in leadership that people have seen. I think when everything is going, it's easy to be a politician when everything's going well, right? You kiss babies, you dance with seniors, you know, you go to picnics, and it's great. But when things aren't so great, or when there are challenges, that's when I think leadership is most important. That's when I think we have to galvanize, right? And come together and really need leadership. And I think that's when we saw it break apart in our district anyway, a little bit. And around the city too. So I think that's why I thought, and just being on the community board, I saw it maybe a little more intimately. Enough meetings. And you referenced that, less talk, more action. Yeah. I can't tell you how many meetings about one topic I've been to. Like, you know, there could be a topic, I can be a dozen meetings about it. Finally, you know, I said, guys, we're talking about the same thing over and over. Let's do it. And I'll give you an example, then I can get to the platform. I'll give you an example. So in March, when everything started shutting down last year, remember, everyone was kind of like, what's going on? Schools were shut down. No one knew how long COVID was going to last, but we kind of knew as we got into it that something was going to have to be done with schools in September. It wasn't going to be the same. So I went to my city councilman's office. I talked to them and other people, and I said, listen, guys, we have to have some sort of plan for September, right? We don't know what's going on with teachers. The parents are nervous. It doesn't look like kids are going to go back full time. Let's get a plan. And this was the reaction I got. Leslie, the DOE is just so big, you know, they're handling it. I said, what are they handling? We haven't seen a plan. So that was frustrating. And I said, I'm going to do it myself. I'm just going to do something myself. So over the summer, I called Columbia University, NYU, Pace, SUNY, a lot of the higher education institutions in our neighborhood or in our nearby. And I said, guys, listen, if we're having problems here in elementary school, then what are your student teachers doing? Because you don't have placements either for them if there's no in-person learning. Mm-hmm. Can we use your student teachers and maybe get them to teach our elementary school kids virtually? Because that's where we're seeing that parents are having a really, really tough time with, that they can't be at three places at once. They can't work. They can't teach their kids at the same time. You know, it's madness. And they said, that's a great idea. So we worked together with the principals, with the higher education institutions, and we started the Student Teacher Virtual Learning Initiative.
That's brilliant.
Thank you. Yeah. And guess what? And so we want to get all our ducks in a row, uh-huh. and we presented to the DOE, and guess how long it took them to approve it? One day.
Wow.
Nothing happens in the DOE in one day. They, you know, it's funny when we...
And that's run out in just this district?
Just this district. No, okay. Justice District. And I wanted to concentrate on Title I schools. Uh-huh. So I don't know if anyone who's listening knows what Title I schools are, but they are designated schools that have a number or percentage of children or families that are below a certain poverty line or an income level. So we have three elementary schools that are Title I schools. So I said, guys, I want this initiative in there. Mm-hmm. Because also what we were finding is that, and you might have heard this, parents started getting private tutors. They started doing their own personal pods. And these kids, these parents couldn't afford that.
Yeah, of course.
They couldn't even stay home with their kids. They were either essential workers or they had to go to work. So I said, why don't we get these student teachers to help these kids in pods? Uh-huh. And that's what we did. So now they're in our three Title I schools. Hundreds of kids are getting virtual learning right now, live virtual learning, all because of that initiative. Uh-huh. I'm super, super proud of it. And I was just told, actually, I had a conference. I'm friends now with all these administrators of the university. And the one from SUNY was telling me, she goes, you know what? Rochester, upstate, wants to copy your model.
That's what my next question is. Why isn't this being scaled out?
Yes, it is. It is. So I know upstate, they copied our model. Mm-hmm. And they did, I don't know if it's exactly the same, but they did use student teachers to go virtually online. And I know I've had other boroughs ask me, they're like, hey, wait a minute. Yeah. Are you taking all of our student teachers?
And, so how does it work?
So what the thing, what the problem was that there was going to be blended learning, meaning half the kids are going to be in school, in person.
Yeah.
And then the other half was going to be a virtual, and then they would flip every week or every other week, whatever the designated scheduling was.
Yep.
So obviously a DOE teacher can't teach in school and at the same time teach virtually. So what was going to happen was, and I foresaw this was going to happen, that the kids at home were going to get just lame worksheets and then or some sort of lesson plan. And who's going to have to do that? The parents are caretakers, right? And
they or nothing.
Or nothing, right? The kids, exactly. And we're talking first, second, third, fourth grade. These are kids that need direction.
Yeah, when you're critical, in high school, critical time.
Yeah, it's a little different. You're in high school, maybe, you know, they're more self-sufficient, right? You can do homework and lessons on your own. So how it works is the student teachers are assigned to a certain class, and then they just, every hour, they just keep logging on, and they get, I want it to be small pods, because if it was four, five, or six kids, they would get the individual attention they needed. Plus, they would get peer interaction online that they needed, too. You know, they would be able, it's not like 20 kids on a Zoom, and it gets crazy. So that was very important to me as well, that it would be small pods. Small pods, Title I schools, and it's working. So that's how it works. And then these student teachers, oh, by the way, did I mention the best part? It's free.
Oh, well,
the DOE doesn't have to pay for it. So, you know, because it's student teachers and they're getting the accredited hours too.
And these teachers are coming from which institutions?
I think, I don't know, I can find out exactly our schools, but I know SUNY has some kids, I think, in PS 51 and PS 33, Pace University, Columbia.
So it's great that they're supporting it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. There's, in fact, that was one of my selling points to the DOE and also to the teachers union. I said, guys, they're helping out your educators. Mm-hmm. They're giving them a break. But also, they're your teachers next year. They're in your pipeline.
Yeah.
So now they're getting this virtual learning experience and teaching, you know, as they go. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of like they're learning on the job, too. It actually, it was a win-win-win. We really could see not one downside. And usually there's a upper downside to something. There was literally no downside. So I went back. I said, see, we did it. Uh-huh. There was something that can be done.
Yeah.
It's just, Mark, and this is another reason why I'm running. It's just having the political will and thinking outside the box. Now, is everything you think of going to work? No. You know, every idea you have? No. But that's the point. You have these ideas, and then you push as hard and as far as you can go to make it work.
But it is, it's a natural human reaction of feeling that one person, what difference can one person make?
Yes.
But once someone has an idea and takes an idea and tries to implement it, that's when action occurs and circumstances change and people get behind you. So it's wonderful that that's happened.
Yeah, thank you.
That's education.
Yep.
Other issues that are systemic issues, not just internationally, nationally, in the city and in the district, revolve certainly around environment. It's
absolutely
an issue in front of everyone, most people's minds. affordable housing, the need for small business support, which has been necessary over the last few years anyway. What are your perspective on those issues?
Yeah, so I am concentrating on, there are three platform positions that I would say are my core ones in this race. Not to exclude others, but these are the ones I'm kind of concentrating on right now. One, first and foremost, is COVID relief. First and foremost. And that encompasses small businesses. That encompasses education, because we still have, you know, what we're going to do in September. It's going to get a little better than it was this year, but still we have to address that.
Yep.
COVID relief, first and foremost, you know, is the first and foremost on my mind. The second thing is affordable housing and homelessness. My position is that we have to have affordable housing across the board. And we can dive into that a little more too. My third is, you touched upon it, and it's near and dear to my heart, environmental justice.
Yeah.
I think that is one thing that people say, what could I do? The environment is so big, you know, oh, it's such a big not true. There is something we can do in our district specifically, and I can give you examples as well, but I think that it's not as macro as we think. Like, we can do things in our neighborhood. We really can. And I know people are like, well, recycling or this, but there, I'll give you an example. This is another let's talk, more action type of thing. So I read an article, geez, it was in the New York Times. It must have been almost 2 years, a year and a half ago at least, almost 2 years ago, that said the cruise ships on the west side of Manhattan, right? They line up at the Manhattan cruise terminals. We have them here. They spew out, one cruise ship spews out the equivalent of 34,000 idling tractor trailers a day of carbon emissions.
Wow.
One cruise ship in one day, the equivalent of
34,000. Even when they're docked?
Yes. Yeah, because they're running.
Yeah.
Because they're, well, when they're running, they're running. Yeah. And you see the smokestack, 34,000 tractor trailers. And, like, you know, we talk about cars and this. There is like a huge problem right there. So on the west side, we're getting all that dirty air and we don't even realize it.
But what can be done about that? Because obviously there a key thing that's been missing with COVID has been the tourists. I mean, the 60 million people that come into this city are absolutely fundamental to the, not just the character of the city and the energy, but the economy. So we can't get rid of the cruise ships. Presumably.
No, but I'll tell you what I've done. I'll tell you, you know what we could do? We can plug them in. We can get them on shore power. And you're like, you're probably thinking, oh, that's such a big thing. Almost 50% of Princess Cruise Liners, Norwegian, are already outfitted for electric power. Uh-huh. We're the ones that are behind. Canada, they're already plugging in. West Coast, they're already plugging in. You know, the Norwegian, they're already plugging in.
Wow.
Why
I didn't
are we
know
not
that.
Why are we not plugging in? So I researched it. I called the Nova Scotia. I actually talked to the guy who heads the Nova Scotia terminal there. And I said, you know, please give me, you know, I want the full story. I want everything because I want to understand this before I move forward. And then I got the Con Ed here together with the CDC here, all like the components to the table. And I worked with Brad Hoyleman's office, Senator Brad Hoyleman's office as well. And I called them. I go, guys, let's take the first steps for shore power. And there was a little pushback, the same as with the education. They said, oh, Leslie, that's going to be 5 to 8 years from now. Yes, maybe. But don't we have to take the first step?
Yeah, exactly.
First?
It's got to start somewhere.
So that doesn't mean we don't do it. I didn't understand. They actually do it in Red Hook, Brooklyn. I don't know how well that's going right now, but we can do it here. So right now we are in talks, and Con Ed already gave us, like, you know, what they thought we needed. Now we need a load letter, and it's moving forward. And Con Ed said it's absolutely doable. We don't have the capacity right now, but we can get the grid capacity there. So all this is doable, Mark. It's all doable. It's just having the political will and to push it forward. So that's one I think would be a huge, huge environmental change in our neighborhood.
Okay. And affordable housing, that's a key issue for the city.
Absolutely. And the next, you know, that's another thing that I don't know if people realize. People are like, well, we don't have enough housing. We don't have enough housing. I got to tell you, there are projects that are being done in our district that are slated, and the next city council person is going to have to oversee those projects. They're more in the northern part of our district. So up in Hell's Kitchen, there are already designated spots. One is called the DEP site. You might know it.
Yes.
And one's the MTA site. They're actually close together, a few blocks north and south of each other. But these sites are date all the way back to the Hudson Yards points of agreement. Mm-hmm. So just to give a teeny bit of background, when Hudson Yards went up, there were probably hundreds and hundreds of pages of contracts that went into that, right, with the city. But part of it was they would be an 80-20, meaning 80% market rate units and 20% low and very low income units. And they did that. They put the 80-20, but also part of it was they were required, or they would have to be a provision for working class income housing as well. So they would be very high over there, very low and very, very low income, and low income, excuse me, bands. But they would also have to be eventually moderate and working class. And that's what the DEP and the MTA site are designated now. That was part of the points of agreement. It's been there for years. Recently, and this is where you said, where are the differences in this race?
Yes.
And this is one big difference, I believe, in myself and Eric, who's also running, Eric Botcher. They want to change that now, that part of the points of agreement. I want to stick to the points of agreement. And I am backed by my block associations in the area and also unanimously by the community board.
So to be specific, the difference, the changes that you don't want to happen are what?
So they are now saying they want to change that points of agreement and say we want it to be very low income housing.
Yeah.
And which is needed too, absolutely. But we keep sacrificing our working class housing and those median income housing
bands.
What
would the impact be on those working class families and individuals?
Exactly. Well, a lot. It would be great. I mean, right now what we're seeing, at least in our area, is the very, very high, the billionaires row, and then we're starting to see the very, very low, which is good, which is fine, but we need the bridge in between for that balance. And I'll tell you, everyday impacts that you'll see when that middle income, that medium income is sucked out of the equation. Number one, people can't work where they live. We see a lot of people who work here, whether they have service jobs, waiting jobs, you know, whatever, secretarial jobs, administrator jobs, and they're coming from the outer boroughs because they can't afford to live here. And that's not fair. They, you know, you should be able to work where you live. And by the way, that's an environmental concern too, because you know, we want people to be able to work where they live. Mm-hmm. That's another component of my environmental, you know, points. But
and it also has an impact on the actual character and fabric of the neighborhood.
Absolutely.
People aren't working.
Yeah, you want people to kind of have a stake in their neighborhood, right? Mm-hmm. And they live there, they work there, and you get to know your neighbors. Another thing is why it's so important to have this band of income in throughout all neighborhoods is because these are the people that contribute to the PTA. These are the people that go to the local stores and get, like, you know, a bag of oranges in the morning. You know, these are the people where their kids are involved. These are the people that spend $5, you know, at the local stand. Mm-hmm. These are the people that volunteer. I think it's very important to keep that. And I'm not saying exclude the other bands at all. I'm saying, but when there are points of agreement, it was very, very specifically laid out.
Yeah.
It's like a puzzle piece. You know, it's like a puzzle pieces. And when you take one part away, there's an imbalance there that is hard to make up.
Just from my benefit, are these houses already built?
No, not yet. They're sites right now.
Okay.
There are.
So this decision is critical to move forward with the actual.
Absolutely. And there, so pre-COVID, when we found out from Corey Johnson's office that we're just going to change, you know, we're changing it, there was a huge outcry in the community board, which I'm on community board 4, which is partners of community board 2, which are down here.
Yeah.
We sent letters. And this was across the board. This had nothing to do with where you ranged on the, you know, the political spectrum at all. It was more of, number one, you can't break a promise. Like, you can't break an agreement with the community. Mm. Because then if administrations did that from one administration to another, there would be no point of making a contract, number one. Number two, you can't just take away one puzzle piece and not the other. You know, it's a balance. That's what we're saying. Yeah. So that is kind of what we're fighting for. And I guess COVID helped us a little bit because it froze the EULAR process. It froze a lot of these projects with COVID. So let's see now things starting to get back, we're still going to be fighting for that. We are a little concerned that they're not listening to us. And so far they have been pushing back saying, sorry, we're not going to stand by our agreement. Uh-huh. And that's a little nerve-wracking.
But ultimately, whose decision is it?
It's probably mostly the mayor's office, but there's also the city council person has a very big say in what happens in their district. Mm-hmm. So usually city hall will then, I don't want to say defer, but they will counsel with whoever the representative is. That's why it's so important whoever the next city council person is.
Yeah, deciding that.
Exactly. I don't think, you know, those are nuances that people don't maybe understand that whoever the next city council person is will have a say or at least some sort of influence over what goes on in these very, very, very important projects in our district moving forward.
And that is an important hyperlocal issue.
Very. It's very important. I mean, listen, you know this. Mm. If there's very, very high and very, very low, I'm not saying this. I mean, this is economists. These are urban planners. A community collapses within itself because you don't have that middle, you know, that's the structure that actually has to be the strongest.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. So let's say you're elected. What would your first or your top priority be? I mean, there's a lot of issues there to be resolved.
Yeah. Definitely, like I said, COVID relief. I mean, we have to get our small businesses going. Yeah. Like I said, my parents owned a small business. I am very familiar. But I think small business relief has to be the first thing. Now, there is a lot of, I know there are a lot of, you know, this bill is coming, that bill, or definitely first and foremost, and this should have been done already, first and foremost should have been financial relief. Mm-hmm. We should have had, I mean, listen, we understand there was an administration and the federal government that was in that maybe did not share our concerns, especially here in New York City. Mm-hmm. But we do have a state government that should help. We do have now, hopefully, friendlier people in federal government that should help. That's a no-brainer. Listen, I'm a Democrat, right? So that's what I believe.
Yeah.
I believe there should be aid. I believe there should be funds. Other than that, I think there was a loss of mom-and-pop shops before COVID. There was a problem even...
rent increases.
Yeah, there were. I mean, across... not just rent increases, but commercial spaces that were holding out for, you know, the bigger, better bang for your buck.
Yeah.
And there was no incentive for them not to do so. You know, let's just keep it open for 3 years. Who cares? Let's get Citibank in there who will pay a 30-year, right, lease.
Yeah.
But also the mom-and-pop stores were struggling to sell their items. And when I say mom and pops, I mean like the things that sell stuff, not the service like the banks or the pharmacies, but the things that sell like here, like that sell clothes and things. Mm-hmm. They were having a hard
time. Hardware stores.
Exactly. Yeah. And why was that? The Amazon effect. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Purely the Amazon effect. Yes, rents were going up, but they couldn't keep up with that because of the Amazon effect. They were seeing that people wanted... they want to click, right? You want the ease of getting everything in a cart, one-stop shopping, let's go, click, I get it tomorrow or in 2 days.
Yeah.
We have to rethink how we shop local. Like, I don't know if that is necessarily a city council person's, you know, responsibility, but I think it is. I think it's part of it. Mm-hmm. I think it's part of getting your neighborhood vibrant again and going again. So we have to reinvent how we shop local. And this is what we talked about with Shop In. If you don't mind me mentioning. So I was with my team researching how can we get our mom and pop shops, you know, going without the obvious, you know, lobbying for funds and bills, because that's a slog and we know that has to go through a process, right?
Yeah.
So I was introduced to, or I noticed a business called Shop In NYC. And I'm like, oh, this is interesting. Let me see. And it was just out of Brooklyn. It was a Brooklyn-based e-commerce website.
Yeah.
And I researched it and I found it was a female owned business, which of course I loved right off the bat.
Bonus.
Yeah. It was a bonus. Yeah. Exactly. And I said, okay, let me call her and talk to her. So what it was is that this woman, Maya, she was, bringing together a lot of the businesses, the mom and pop stores in Brooklyn, and putting them all on one website. They all had their own websites. But she's like, the problem is we want ease of service. Get them all on one website, right? And we deliver same day. Or if you if it's later in the day you order, it's next day delivery. So that's where the competition is.
So it's like a hyperlocal Amazon.
Exactly. Exactly. Or yeah, it is. Yeah. So I said, this is unbelievable. This is great. You know, like this is what we need. Because not only does it give the store something, but it connects residents to shop. It makes them easier to shop local, right? People want to shop local. If I'm in Hell's Kitchen and I want candlesticks at a store in the Village, but I don't want to go down there. You know, I'm having a dinner party. I don't want to go down there. Let me click and do this and I get it that night. So we had negotiations with her and I go, hey, can you bring this to my district in District 3, which is the West Village, Chelsea, Hell's Kitchen? And she's like, well, we were thinking of expanding. We weren't sure where. I go, well, I know where. It's going to be my district. And we made sure we secured that. And now shopping is just in Manhattan in our district.
That's great.
Yeah.
And I mean, building awareness of that is obviously critical as well. I mean, as you say, people may want to shop small and shop local. But one, giving them the civic responsibility and the information necessary to allow them to do it is the other thing. So how do we get the word out?
Yeah, so we've been doing social media. We've been putting out, Shopin has been putting out ads. We just got some of the big residential buildings have agreed to put it into their, like, quote unquote, concierge service or something, or at least have their members aware of it. But you're right, it's just getting out the word. And the more, hopefully, word spreads, the more it grows. Because I've already seen on, you know, social media, like, oh, I just ordered from Shopin. And, you know, we actually ordered all our, we ordered bags of hand sanitizer from Shopin and we got it the next day, which
it's
was great. Yeah, for our petitioning.
Okay.
So
well, we've shared it before and we'll share it again. I think it's great.
It's really, really great.
Before COVID, the fabric of neighborhoods was changing. We've talked about rising rents, commercial rents. There's been changing demographics. How do we build back a stronger sort of community spirit and stronger neighborhoods going forward? Not just in District 3, but just across the city.
Yeah.
It's a big challenge.
I absolutely think so. And I think one of it is people have to come back. I mean, listen, that's the no-brainer. And, you know, it's not something we can control. People have to come back. I mean, I'm sure you see it in your neighborhood. I've seen it in my neighborhood. People fled.
Yeah.
People left, whether it was permanent or temporary. I can tell you, I don't see half as much as foot traffic as I do, you know, as I did before. People have to know it's safe to come back. It's okay to come back. Stores are open. I think our district, there is a little bit of a wrinkle that's different in our district because our district is so inextricably tied to Broadway and live performances, at least up in the northern part of the district. And unfortunately, that's, you know, we can't do anything in the until the tourists come back. And when the tourists come back, the restaurants will open. When the restaurants, you know, open, then the shops will open. It's just so unfortunately, we do have to wait for that part of the community to come back.
Talking vaccines.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And not just here. It's international. If we're going to
absolutely,
the tourists come back.
Because people are going to exactly things will pick up. We will come back. I am absolutely positive of it. It's just that we have a lot of people, not only that are performers that live in our district, but people behind the scenes. They build the sets. They are the makeup artists. They either left because they couldn't afford it anymore because they don't have a job, right? They went back to their hometowns or they moved right outside the city. And so, you know, we're seeing a big empty hole there. And I think those people have to come back. And I think to loop it back into affordable housing and commercial rents, two things. Yeah. One, there are some, like I said, points for affordable housing. I'm going to bring up another one. Bayview Prison, which is a state prison. It's right in Chelsea. It was a woman's prison for many, many years. I don't know if you know it.
I didn't know there was a prison in Chelsea.
Yeah, there was. Yeah, it's a state prison. Yeah. It's right on the West Side Highway. It's actually a beautiful building with mosaics and beautiful tiles. After Hurricane Sandy, there was some damage, so it's been vacant ever since. Empty. So I just said to some of our state representatives, I said, why aren't we making that into affordable housing specifically for artists or educators? Those are the people we need to come back. And they said that has been talked about. You know, the state is dragging its heels on that for a number of reasons. But again, we're back to political will, mm-hmm. political will, let's get it done. So that's where I think things come back. And commercial rents, I do believe that we can implement rent stabilization for nonprofits or arts. Mm-hmm. If we have it for private individuals, there can be, when these big glossy buildings go up and they do, 80-20 or now 70-30s,
yeah.
we can put a bottom floor in. Part of it can be also mm-hmm. some sort of commercial rent stabilized for an independent theater or a nonprofit, because mm-hmm. those are the ones that the arts, our arts community is just getting killed and they need spaces.
We were speaking to Matthew, who works with, runs Waltz Next Door, the restaurant on Washington Street. Mm-hmm. And he was just reflecting on one of the biggest challenges the restaurant industry have coming back is finding talent. Because, as you said, people have left the city.
Yep.
They couldn't afford to stay here. Even if some people start to come back, others won't, because they found other opportunities elsewhere.
Yeah.
And that's going to be presumably a challenge in the city as well, particularly for the entertainment industry, is when the tourists come back.
Yeah, really? You think it's going to be hard to get people back? I don't, because I think it regenerates. Yeah. I think people will see this. I see it as it's like an opportunity mm-hmm. to press the restart button. And in many, I mean, we're talking education, we're talking housing. I mean, this is actually a silver lining where we're kind of now building again from the mm-hmm. bottom up. But I do think that there are people out.
Or maybe a new generation.
Exactly. It might not be the same people. Yeah. It might not be the same. You're right. It might not be the same, but it's going to be that kid in Kansas who always thought of coming here. And now, guess what? Mm. He's going to start anew. He's going to come here. Someone from the UK.
Yeah.
Right? Who's like, you know what? This is it. This is my chance. They're reopening.
Yeah.
I'm going to go. So I do think you're right. It might be a new crop of people. It might not be the same exact people, but they're always going to come back to New York.
Yeah.
I think they'll always
come back to New York. The magnetism of the city is never going to change.
Yeah.
Okay. You talk about small business, but mm-hmm. I mean, we're sitting in a retail space at the moment that just opened, I believe, a couple of weeks ago, which shows that there is a healthy degree of innovation and entrepreneurship that exists in the city.
Yes.
And as the West Village is just a hub of innovation and invention and creativity through the decades. It's good to see places like Fireplace 409 opening in such harsh conditions. So that's certainly a positive sign that things are actually happening and there's vibrancy sort of coming back into the city. But what can you do as a representative of the city to foster innovation and inward investment from the investment community?
Yeah. So COVID didn't kill creativity. It didn't kill ingenuity. It didn't kill spirit. It might have hurt the spirit a bit, but it didn't kill our minds. I mean, this is a great example of it, right? I mean, someone saw an opportunity, and that's what we're hoping right now. I mean, listen, it's maybe coincidental that it's becoming spring, but we are seeing sprouts, right? We are seeing little sprouts come up of some place like here, or there's a Thai food restaurant that just opened up, a little north of here. And I asked them, I said, why are you opening up now? They're like, because, we see an opportunity. We see that we can start something. And I think we're going to see that more and more. Now, I think we can foster that as a community. I think there's things we can do to foster small businesses just in general, by supporting small businesses. And I think that's by a lot of social media, a lot of work, getting the word out. Hey, we're coming back. I think we should have a full-on blitz of we're coming back. I mean, you see all in Chelsea, all in Times Square, all in. And I think that's a very good message to send. But I do think we're coming back. I just think, like you said, once the vaccines start coming, through, that it's going to be, once again, the vibrancy that we did see right before COVID as well. Now, specifically as far as what we can put through with City Council, I think we still have to concentrate on our people of color, the businesses, ownership, people of color, our women-owned businesses, and I think we can help them. I think we can help them with grants. I think we can give them seed money. We talked about this, offline. We talked about environmental bonuses, people who want to do green initiatives for their businesses. That's what we should be fostering. because like I said, this is a time to press the restart button. And this is when we can do those things. It's not, let's not go back to business as usual. Let's move forward. Let's, you know, let's think forward. Let's think ahead.
I've been speaking to people about, particularly Julia Davies, who's currently a resident of New York, but living in California for the moment. And I was talking to her about...
Tell her to come back.
Yeah, I think she will be coming back once she has the vaccine. About local economic zones. I mean, again, as you mentioned, we talked offline, but what do you think can be done to encourage or to create platforms or capacity for businesses, local businesses, whether medium to small to large, and there's plenty of them in New York, to collaborate, to communicate together, to see how they can collectively work together on initiatives. I mean, I know that everyone's just really got their heads down trying to sort of survive, let alone sort of build and scale, but times will change a year from now, a year and a half from now, with a new administration in the city. There is an opportunity to do things differently. And I'm just wondering if there's you see an ability or a possibility to connect businesses together in some form of forum to take responsibility for the, in their, let's say, their civic duty in the city.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I do think these local economic zones, as you say, or these shop zones, I do think they formed organically here in New York City. We definitely see pockets of them, right? Mm-hmm. Especially in our district. That's the one thing where I think we have to work on, what you just mentioned. So we have very strong neighborhood and block organizations, right? We have little block associations, and then they form bigger associations, and then they form community boards. Mm-hmm. And I think our dialogue and conversation amongst residents is very good. There are ways to connect to each other. Conversely, I don't think they're as strong when it comes to businesses. I think we do have a local chamber of commerce. I do think we do have a Manhattan Chamber of Commerce. I just don't think the communication is as strong as we do with the residents. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you if that's what you were maybe implying, that that can be stronger. I think sometimes, though, a little bit of it is that people, shop owners don't necessarily live here. So they come to work and they go. But I think it's different now. I think shop owners want that sense of community. Mm-hmm. I think they want to... attached to other shop owners, whether they're along the same lines of business or not, you know, doesn't matter. I think they want that camaraderie. I think we should form little groups of like-minded, like we were talking about environmental. Like we were talking, like we have people who shop owners or business owners that are environmentally conscious and they're trying to do the right thing with their business or their product, right? Mm. Why don't we get them together?
I mention it because I was speaking with, I was interviewing Ben Hartley, who's the executive director of the National Arts Club. Mm-hmm. And he was saying how he has pivoted during COVID to creating a sort of platform where ambassadors and consulate members from other countries can come together and connect with each other and network in a way they've never done before in an environment, if they want to come to the art club or they do it on Zoom. But there now, he's building that sort of connective tissue between them to talk about issues that they all share. And it got me thinking, why isn't that happening at scale in the city where you can bring together businesses, whether they be businesses in the garment district or be a collective of restaurants and retailers where they maybe all have a passion to do something, to have an impact in the city, but they don't know where to start.
Right.
And it's being in a position that as a council member would have is to be able to create that connective tissue and to encourage that conversation and that dialogue and to agree actions that people can take individually and collectively. And I think that's probably a great opportunity for whoever is elected to start to create
because
that.
Because what happens is they learn from each other, right? It's like they build upon each other's ideas. Like you said, someone can have an idea, but it's in a vacuum, but another business can really maybe move on it, right?
Well, that's where innovation comes from,
exactly.
Is through sort of diverse ideas coming together in a space where people can share ideas and build on them.
Yep. I agree 100%. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I think I'm the only candidate in this race, actually, that is really concentrating this heavily on small business revitalization. And not just, I support this bill, or I support this bill. It's doing something. It's getting your hands dirty. It's getting in there. It's bringing people together. It's less talk, more action.
I should. Okay. Exactly. Well, I think, I mean, that's a good way just to sort of wrap this up. I mean, sure. There's certainly at the moment, there is a lot of talk going on in all the different districts across the city.
Yeah.
And the action's going to happen come June. So I hope that we're in a position to whoever is elected, and good luck with the
Thank
race,
you.
That we will see a lot of action coming out of this, and we see an acceleration in policy into action in the city, and a return to the vibrancy and the character that was New York before, and building a more resilient local economy and more resilient neighborhoods and communities.
I'm sure of it. It's not a doubt in my mind. Well, it's not a doubt, and I want to be a part of it.
Okay. Well, whether you're elected or not, I'm sure you're going to continue to make your voice heard, and I look forward to continuing the conversation.
This was great.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you very much. Yeah.